Twice. There we go. Okay. Somewhere. All right. Well, first off, I want to, of course, thank everyone for showing up and thank you for being here. I also want to thank Marsh and Jonathan for being here. Let's see here. In short, this workshop is, of course, we invited Marsha and Jonathan Stone from Austin, Texas. So they will be delivering a workshop with the intention or the vision and the topic being staying connected to your powerlessness. I have, as a group consciousness, we allow the facilitators to kind of just do whatever they're led to do. So once we sit down, they're going to basically just bring the heat. They're going to share their experience and their understanding through the power of the steps and God in their life. We do all that cool stuff. We have snacks, some food. We're getting pizza around the lunch break. Please help yourself to any drinks. If you need anything and I can help you, cool. If not, then, I don't know, time now. Just order something and I'll tell you. But we've got a bunch of stuff here. And then I know Amanda's got an announcement. If you want to make that before I forget.
Hey, everybody. My name's Amanda. I'm out home tonight.
Hey, Amanda.
I am in my church, and they are really nice about giving us this space twice a year so that we can do these workshops. Caveat is it has to look exactly like it did when we all first came in. So depending on what time you got here. Yeah. So, and they do have like a class in this room tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. So be careful when you're eating and stuff because we're going to have to clean it up, vacuum and all that good stuff. Be careful about spills. They just put this carpet in. Mm-hmm. There's a receptacle for cigarette butts on the other side of the thing. It's a giant galvanized can. Can't miss it. Of course, the bathrooms are over there. And if you have any questions about anything here, let me know. Just so you know, this is a recovery-friendly church. Recovery is part of this church. We have huge recovery meetings here several nights a week, and our service has always got a recovery theme as well, as somebody just mentioned that also. And I'm going to go make a big pot of coffee now, so try not to talk about anything too important while I'm
there. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks.
And I also want to thank people that were here that helped us get set up. I want y'all to know that because we're falling on a budget here, right? I had to really, get down to it to get snacks that were appropriate but within this little budget. So I need to thank Jamie for making all the muffins and cookies because it's a lot cheaper to make muffins than it is to buy them.
Yeah.
And she did it. And I still had time to do it this weekend, so she stayed up and did it all when I was running around about. And real quick, I'm really excited for all of you just who was led here to attend and to be present. These two individuals are not only, really, there's some things you could talk a lot of stuff, but I've had personal interactions with them over a long period of time. I've had phone conversations with them, and they truly do carry the message that they share. So, and it's a really, for me, it touches my spirit. It really does wake me up. It's inspiring. So I want to thank you guys for coming all the way down, taking your time to do this and sharing your experience with us. And you just run the show. If you need anything from me, let me know. So with that, let's get this going.
Woo!
Yeah.
All right.
Yes. Thank you so much, Lindsay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Marsha Stone. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marsha.
I'm from Austin, Texas. My sobriety date's May 6, 2008. I've got a sponsor. Her name's Katie P., and she's got a sponsor whose name is Marty R., and I sponsor tons of women, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and the 12 Steps and the fellowship that goes along with that. You know, and Jonathan and I sat this morning together and said a little prayer before we came up here, and one of the things that I'm most grateful for is that Jonathan and I get to travel all over the place and do things like this and really talk about and share with other people our experience and our strength and our hope, both with addiction and alcoholism and with the recovery process and what our life looks like now with God in the center of our marriage and in the center of our family and in the center of our lives. And, you know, the big book talks about it's an experience you must not miss, and that's my experience as well. I identify myself as an alcoholic because I mostly attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but when I'm in Cocaine Anonymous, I identify myself as an addict. And the reason is my alcoholism showed up in lots of different ways, and we'll talk about that today. And one of the ways that it showed up was through cocaine and through opiates and really just about any other ism that could change the way that I felt about me and get outside of the bondage of self that I carry around with me at all times. So, you know, the title of this workshop is Staying Connected to Your Powerlessness. And Jonathan spoke last night and the night before, and that's one of the things that's most important in our own recovery stories and in our own recovery process, is the power of that first step and the identification with powerlessness that brings me to my knees and makes me desperate enough to stay in willingness to stay connected to God. So before we get started today, Jonathan and I sat down yesterday, and we've got a series of questions that we want to pose to the people that are here today. Because if you're here today, then there's some power that led you to this room. You know, I'm sure that it's raining outside, it's cold, you guys would like to be snuggled up, maybe watching Netflix and, you know, catching up on the season or the episode that you missed last night. But you're here, and there's a reason that you're here, and I really believe that to the core of my being. So the objective right before we get started is going to be for me to read these questions. I don't know if you guys brought notepads or whatever to write on. If you didn't, we've got some paper we can share with you. But I want you to sit with these considerations as you think about what led you here today, and then we're going to do about a five-minute meditation, and then we're going to jump off into talking about powerlessness specifically. We're going to go till about 12 today. We're going to be marathon runners this morning, and then we're going to have some lunch, and then we'll do some breaks this afternoon. But this is important. Step one is the deal, and that's why we're here. So here's the questions that I'd like for you to sit with for a few minutes and really have some prayerful consideration about these. The first question is, ask yourself, do you want to live? Knowing that to drink or to use is to die. And knowing what course of action is required to stay in fit spiritual discipline or condition. Are you willing to do that to continue living? Knowing that it is now a choice whether or not to do that, because we've tapped into an inner resource, which is the power of God. The second series of considerations are these. Am I willing to live by doing what the program says I must do? Am I willing to live in the disciplines of steps 10, 11 on a daily basis? Am I willing to do 12-step work? And am I willing to practice principles in all of my affairs? The third consideration is, do my actions, not my thoughts, not my words, not my ideas or my intentions, but do my actions currently support my decision to live via the spiritual program of action called recovery? And the fourth consideration is, do I want what these people have, am I willing to go to any length to get it? So we're going to do about a five-minute meditation while we consider those things, and then we'll jump into the work.
Lindsay, you want me to pause the recording?
Do what?
You want me to pause the recording?
Whatever.
Okay.
Because I don't know.
Yeah, me neither. All right, guys, ready? Started it.
Then we'll say a set aside prayer. God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, the big book, the 12 steps, the fellowship, the program, and all spiritual things, so that I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me see the truth. Amen.
Amen.
So in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a line and it says that the first step in recovery is conceding to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic. So one of the things that we have to start to look at are these words. And what are the meaning of these words, and what is our experience with these words? So when we're talking about the word conceding to my innermost self, making a concession, admitting defeat, you know, we all have our own experience with what that means, and that's the experience that ultimately propels us into seeking power and stop playing God. The problem is, once we get into recovery, even if it's for a week or 2 weeks or a month or years, our ego reconstructs at such an alarming and powerful rate that it's very difficult for us to stay connected to that initial concession. One of the things that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, or Cocaine Anonymous, sets us up to do is to continue to work with others, to continue to take a daily inventory of our thought life and our behavior, and to continue to practice principles in all of our affairs to keep us right-sized, to keep us humble. But then again, our humanness shows up, and we get lazy, or we get egotistical, or we get distracted, or we get to thinking that we, you know, have some delusion of power, and we begin to walk away from the feeling and the concession and the behavior that initially connected us with our first step. And that's the main thing that we want to address today: staying connected to our powerlessness, practicing principles in all of our affairs, and looking at what are the balking points that keep us from being connected to our step one. Typically, those are things like inventory. Those are things like amends. You know, are you convinced that unfinished amends looks like a drink of whiskey or a line of crack, or I mean coke, or a hit of crack? Are you convinced that if you're not willing to stay in this spiritual condition by practicing the disciplines of steps 10 and 11, by working with others, and by practicing principles in all of your affairs, are you convinced that those are the type of inactions that lead you away from your step one connection to powerlessness and ultimately lead you back to a drink of whiskey or a shot of dope? Those are the considerations that we were just talking about, just using some different language. So the first thing that Jonathan and I were going to talk about this morning is sort of the overview of step one. Do you want to start there, or do you want me to?
Sure. No,
okay.
Hey, guys. My name is Jonathan. I'm an addict and an alcoholic. And just out of curiosity, how many people in the room are in their first 30 days? Okay. And how many of the people in the room, whether it's current or just history, have a relapse history? Okay.
Wow.
Those are my people.
Right.
All right. So the way that the big book breaks down the first step, from our understanding and the way it was brought to us, is the first step falls into three parts. Two major parts. One is powerlessness and the other is unmanageability. But the powerlessness is broke down into two pieces of looking at whether I'm powerless or not. And one involves what happens once I start. And the other one involves what happens when I'm sober with nothing in my body. And, from the doctor's opinion, from the title page to page 23, talks about what happens once I start drinking, right? What they call the phenomenon of craving, or this physical allergy. And then from 23 to 43, talks about what happens when I'm sober. It's the stories like Fred's story, like Jim's story, like the man of 30, like the jaywalker. All those guys had an experience with putting alcohol, and in this room, and or drugs back into their body in a stone-cold sober state. And that's where we find the examples of mental powerlessness. And then on pages 44, 45, and 52, is where we were taught to look at this idea of unmanageability. And, I think that, you know, for me, you guys that had heard me talk, about, a 13-year history of, fits and starts, getting at one point 2 years on fear and momentum, but always putting drugs and alcohol back into my body. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but looking back, the problem that I had for those 13 years is not just a disconnection with my first step, but a severe misunderstanding of what step one meant. You know, for the people, and I think I talked about it the other day, but for the people that are under the delusion that, you know, they got 2 months, and so, you know, in their mind, they're going to choose to put alcohol or drugs back in their body, but this time they're going to get 3 months, and somehow progress along the spiritual path like that, it doesn't really work like that in my experience. If you're able to decide when you start and when you stop and how long you're going to get this time, you really don't suffer from powerlessness like it's described in the book. So that's kind of where we wanted to start, you know, and Marcia's going to do more of the lead, and I'm going to do color commentary. And, we're both going to throw in, our own personal experience. I will tell you this. There's a vast difference between the words admission and concession. Mm-hmm. And for me, for those 13 years that I was going to AA and CA and NA and whatever A I could go into, guys, when I say that I was a meeting maker, that's what I mean. I wasn't going to a meeting once a month. I wasn't going to a meeting once every 6 months. I mean, I'm the pathological sociopath that goes to meetings, picks up chips that I don't deserve because I'm so self-involved, I think you're keeping up with how much time I have. And if I got 30 days a month ago, even though I smoked crack yesterday, 30 days from now I'm going to come up and pick 60 days because I know you're expecting it. I'm the kind of guy that'll go in the bathroom and do dope and then come out and share real well.
Right.
And for those 13 years that I was doing all those shenanigans, I admitted every single time that I was an alcoholic or an addict. But the big difference for me between admitting and conceding is that in my experience, conceding always is followed by action. Admission isn't necessarily followed by action. I can sit up here all day long and tell you I'm alcoholic and addict because I want to fit in. There's not going to be any follow through necessarily with that. When you have a concession, aka a thorough ass whooping, then it's always going to be followed by action. You know? Go ahead.
So if we jump to page 30 in the text, this kind of encapsulates everything that we've been talking about so far, and then we'll do some backtracking as well. But in the chapter more about alcoholism, it really kind of sums up what we've been talking about so far in the first couple of paragraphs. I'm just going to read it just so I can frame the commentary. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. So when we're just to back up a little bit to what Jonathan was talking about this physical piece, which again is found in the text, and you know we like to refer to this book as the text because that's what it really was intended to be, just a little historical context. Before Alcoholics Anonymous and before Cocaine Anonymous were popping up in meetings all over the country in churches, etc., the early founders would, for example, the first guy that was in Houston, the first guy that brought the 12-step meetings to Texas was in Houston. And he wrote to New York to get to General Service Office to get a copy of this book and have it mailed to him down in Texas. And with this book and this book alone, which is why we call it the text, he was able to not only have his own spiritual experience because of the 12-step process, but to set up meetings and to really be the founder of the 12-step meetings that were to come in Texas. So when we talk about from the title page to page 23 is where we find the information about the physical allergy. That's literally what we mean. And when you look at the doctor's opinion, when you're talking about, you know, those early doctors that were sort of thinking that they stumbled onto something about this disease called alcoholism, it was really just based on observation. You know, it wasn't based on, you know, sort of the genetic science that we have now and all of the psychology and all of the, you know, anatomy of the brain and that kind of thing. What these doctors were observing was what every single person in this room, myself included, experienced, which was I wind up in detox or in jail or somehow in a psych ward every single time I go out with the intention to have a couple of drinks and maybe do, you know, an eight ball. You know, it's not even a big deal. You know, it's like Friday night down in, I forgot what Caitlin said the name of the bar was that you guys all used to drink in. What was it? The Buckhead Bar, yeah. Yeah, just go down to the Buckhead Bar and, like, you know, meet up with a couple of my underage friends and, you know, just have a couple. And then next thing we know, you know, we're wrecking our parents' car, we're absolutely going to detox, we're getting arrested, and these things happen over and over again. So what was happening was these doctors, you know, in the first part of the 20th century, in the 1900s, the 1920s, 1930s, were observing that these same people were coming into the hospital time and time again, waking up from their drunken stupor and saying, I didn't mean to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know how this happened. You know, I was just here last week, and I know I was here last week, and I promised you all and myself and my wife and my boss and everybody else involved that I wasn't going to do this again. Mm-hmm. And so what the doctors were observing, you know, was what came to be known as the physical allergy, what came to be known as the phenomenon of craving. And what you guys have to realize, and what I had to really realize and really absorb this first step to the tips of my toes, was that I was not continuing to drink and continuing to use when I had promised not to because of some moral deficiency or because of some, you know, like psychopathic tendency or because I didn't love my children or my parents or my career. And that's the baffling nature of that physical piece, you know. Just like it says in the paragraph that I just read, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, someday, we're going to beat this game. And I stayed in that game for about 15 years, y'all. Really, really wanting to drink properly. Really thinking that if I got a subscription to Wine Spectator magazine, then somehow or another, you know, I wouldn't be drinking from the screw top bottle with the bottle that the handle's made out of the same glass that the bottle's made out of and drinking from it like that, right? I had this delusion that if I advanced my education and, you know, had a 401k and health insurance for my kids and some money in the bank that, you know, I wouldn't be you know, in the bathroom stall at the gas station snorting coke off the top of the toilet, you know, that I'd be doing it from some kind of like silver platter in my lovely living room with drapes to the floor. These are the things that I literally thought about, you know. But what happened was, just as this big book describes in the doctor's opinion, I was maladjusted to life. I was in full flight reality from reality. I could not differentiate the truth from the false. And every single time I went out with a firm intention to just have a couple or just do a couple. I mean, it's interesting to me that, you know, my disease showed up like, well, cocaine was always on board with the drinking. I mean, you know, that was a normal thought process for me. It really was. Like, in my mind, everybody did cocaine. I really believe that. recreationally, you know, on Friday nights. And And no matter what happened, time and time again, I went out with the intention to do this, and I always ended up flat on my face, you know. And you guys will hear more about it in our story a little bit later, but, you know, Jonathan and I are both the type, the real alcoholic, the real addict, that really literally had to lose everything in order for this concession, this proper concession, to take place and take hold. Mm. So.
I was going to say, too, you know, what I try to do when I do these things is you know, line my experience next to what the big book says. And again, for those 13 years of chronic meeting attendance, you know, and 5-6 different rehabs and drug court and all that stuff, I mean, I was at the point towards the end where I could have recited how it works. You know, it had been drilled into my head. And there's such a vast difference between knowing what the big book says and actually having an experience with what the big book says, that it's the difference between night and day. And for me, it was the difference between permanent sobriety and constant relapse. You know, one of our mentors, you know, the main guy that helped us was a guy named Mark Houston. And you know, the one thing that made the biggest difference for me in 2008, when I finally began to have an experience with what the big book said, instead of just being taught the big book and then receiving data or information, there's two main things that flipped it around for me. And one was to turn statements into questions in the big book. And the other was to put my name in where it said they, the, them, men and women, right? It all of a sudden makes the big book come alive if you do that. If you don't do that, I think the tendency is, especially since the ego balks so much at this idea of powerlessness, that I end up reading it like a novel, right? Like a historical novel, and it means nothing to me. But if you guys look, like on page XXVI 26 in the doctor's opinion, I mean, that this is the place where they really start, you know, hammering home this idea of physical powerlessness. And at the top of that, the first full paragraph on XXVI says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to the class of chronic alcoholics and never occurs in the average temperate drinker," which means that if you've ever experienced being overserved, then you're not in the average temperate drinker class. That's what that means, right? And, you know, if you flipped it around, the way that I started doing it that started making sense to me is to read it like this. Jonathan, do you believe that the action of alcohol on you is a manifestation of an allergy and that the phenomenon of craving is limited and never occurs in the average temperate drinker? If you go on further down, at the bottom of the page, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, that's a no-brainer. But instead of reading it like that, I said, Jonathan drinks essentially because he likes the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while Jonathan admits it is harmful, he cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To him, his alcoholic life seems the only normal one. He is restless, irritable, and discontented unless he can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks which I see others taking without consequence. After I have succumbed to the desire again, as I so often do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, Jonathan passes through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with the firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless Jonathan can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of Jonathan's recovery. That's the way you read this book. That's the way you read this book if you want to have an experience. And if you want to be changed from the inside out. You know, I always like to, you know, physical powerlessness. You know, that's something, you know, we're all, like I talked about at my talk at Spearheads, you know, there's a spectrum. I mean, everything that I've read and seen and sponsored makes me come to this idea that there's a scale of alcoholism. And so we all occupy different places on the scale. But, you know, for me, this idea of physical powerlessness is so far in my rearview mirror. I mean, I saw it in high school, right? Once I started, I had a hard time stopping. There are some people that are still in the kind of zip code where they think they're going to drink and it's going to end up okay. And that's fine. But for me, at least toward the end, I knew for sure bad things were going to happen. But it just, you know, the relief that I was going to get from a hit off the crack pipe was worth whatever consequences you could put on the other side of the scale. And so for me, I like to take a look at my different examples or experiences of being physically powerless. And I talked about, you know, my one example Thursday night and then another example Friday night, but I just wanted to reiterate those. You know, when I went out in high school and would tie one on and make a fool of myself or hit on a friend's girl or get in a fight or can't remember and blackout and stuff like that, you know, I would come to with a firm resolution not to repeat that the following weekend. And what I would do is I'd go out and I'd swear up and down, firm resolution style, that I was only going to have two drinks. But I'd start to drink and something really magical would happen at about 1.5 drinks. And I'd say to myself, 2's a fucking stupid number. Who came up with 2? What I meant to say was 4. Or 5, and then when I got close to that number, I'd renegotiate again and say, no, who stops at 5? This is just getting good. I meant to say 10. And that's the way that my drinking would go. And I was under the delusion at the time that as I drank, my mind continued to change. And if you're convinced that that's your truth, that you're changing your mind as you drink, then I have nothing for you. Other than make better decisions, right? This isn't a decision-making process once I start drinking or smoking crack, right? All my decisions are out the door. The other one that I talked about last night was this time back in 2006, 2007. I can't remember, but me and Marshall were already together, and I made a commitment to my son, Wyatt, to show up to his Taekwondo belt testing ceremony. And I was, you know, firmly dedicated. I had everything riding on showing up, right? I needed to prove to my ex-wife that I wasn't a piece of crap, that I could show up for my son. I loved my son. He wanted me to be there. And so I made a commitment to show up like 2 weeks previously. I think the ceremony was like on Wednesday at 6, and me and Marcia started drinking and doing cocaine at about 4 on that Wednesday. And the plan, everyone listen, my plan was I was going to drink and do cocaine until about 5:30 and then shut her down, go show up for the ceremony, and then resume at 7 when I got back, or 6:30, you know, if I was lucky, 6:45.
Good plan.
It was a good plan, and it had lots of merits. It's just that, you know, I wasn't able to pull it off, you know? And, you know, what it looks like to my wife, to my son, if he was enough of an age where, you know, he could wrap his brain around, what it would look like is, I like drinking and drugging more than I love my son. That's what it looks like. But I guarantee you, this isn't the way that it played out. If that was true, then this is what would have happened. 2 weeks previously, I loved my son, but at 5:30 on that Wednesday, I start thinking to myself, you know what? Screw my son. I don't really love him anymore. I think I'm going to just continue to do coke and drink instead and blow him off. That's not the way that went at all. I loved my son just as much at 5:30 as I did 2 weeks previously. But I was unable, once I started, something changed inside me, mentally and physically, that made it virtually impossible for me to stop. And that's what the big book talks about, and I have dozens of those experiences. You know, I had to wrap my brain around this idea that it's not me changing my mind, but be open to the idea that maybe something changes within me once I put it in me. Mm-hmm. And once you got a good beat on that, my recommendation is if you can come up with at least 2 or 3 examples from your past, then you've got a good bead on where you fall on that scale of powerlessness, of loss of power, choice, and control. But I've got to come up with some examples. If I can't come up with any examples of being physically powerless, there's 2 possibilities. Either one is that I'm not. And the second one, which I think is a lot more likely, is that I'm delusional, mm-hmm. right? Or my ego won't let me look at it. Go ahead.
So once we have a real once we've wrapped our mind around our experience with physical allergy, then we kind of move into the second part of powerlessness, which was the part that stumped me for so long. You know, Jonathan talked a lot about it last night, about, you know, being in that category of people that worship the mind. And that was certainly part of my experience as well. You know, I think lots of people in this room can probably identify with this, because my, you know, non-scientific poll is that alcoholics and addicts are some of the smartest, most creative people, you know, with the most ambition and, you know, type A personalities out there.
All right.
And, you know, so that was me. I just, you know, I depended on my mind for so long. Anything I made up my mind to do, I could pretty much do, whether it was school, whether it was, you know, accomplish some kind of goal, you just name it, except for when it came to combating alcoholism and addiction. And it's like just one or two experiences with not being able to trust your mind when it comes to alcohol and drugs didn't do it for me. You know, it's you know, in the first part I read, it said this idea had to be smashed. And I've got lots of experience with smashing that delusional reliance on self and reliance on the mind. So, you know, like we were talking about, right up until page 23, we're really focusing on the doctor's opinion, physical allergy, Bill's story. And then when we get to the bottom of page 22, top of page 23, we start to move into this place where we're going to start talking about the mental obsession. And, you know, when I first got into recovery, I was like, obsession. To me, that word means like, you know, something that I can't stop thinking about. But in this context, what it means is an idea that's going to occur to you when you least expect it, when there's no spiritual defense against the thought that precedes the first drink or drug.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the bottom of page 22, it says, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, so this is like when we all go to detox or we all get out of treatment and there's no alcohol or drugs in our body, right? As he may do for months or years, whether we're staying sober on fear, momentum, probation, whatever the deal is, he reacts much like other men. And that was my experience, y'all. I mean, I'm a chronic relapser, and I started going to treatment in 2002, and the last time I went to treatment was May 6, 2008. And in that six-year period, I was in and out of detox, in and out of psych hospitals, in and out of short-term treatments. In the time periods that I was sober was probably statistically about 95% of those years. Jonathan says 90. Okay, 90% of those 6 years. And during that 90%, like, I looked like your next-door neighbor. Mm-hmm. Drove my car to work every day, took my kids to school, like, had money in the bank, wasn't bouncing checks, wasn't getting arrested, kind of scrubbed up and looked good. I was reacting much like other people. Mm-hmm. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, here's the kicker. These observations, what observations? The observations that I was just making, that even if I'm relapsing a lot, while I'm not drinking, my life resembles that of other people, right? We clean up real well. Mm-hmm. We can put on our little polo shirt, tuck it into our little khaki pants, put on our little belt with the little bullet thing on it from L.L. Bean, our little, right? Talking to the guys in here. Mm-hmm. And the girls, you know, we go down to Banana Republic, get us a new shift dress, put a clip in our hair, and, you know, ready, a little bronzer, we're ready to go, right? These observations that we react much like other people when we're not drinking would be academic, something to think about, and pointless. Of no consequence at all if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Here's an important sentence. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. If you ask him why he started on that last spinner, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, believability, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. So when we're thinking about this mental obsession piece, the example that I always use is also an example that I use because it's really analogous to Jim's story. So I told you the first time I went to treatment was in 2002, and I was in and out of treatment for 6 years between 2002 and 2008. But I was having a spree of abstinence, and from about 2005 to 2007, I was practicing law in North Carolina at that time. And I will never forget this experience, because it is just that moment of insanity that the Big Book talks about that I had never really experienced like this before. I was always under this delusion that I was choosing to drink again, mm-hmm. that I was choosing to do drugs again, because it always felt like there was this planning stage that happened before every single relapse until mm-hmm. this moment. And in February of 2007, I was sitting in my law office one day, minding my own business, you know, probably in full-blown resentment, you know, fear, whatever. But I didn't have any substances in my body. I was going to meetings. I had a sponsor. Now, we weren't working any steps. That was a little aggressive for my case. But, you know, Jonathan was kind of pulled the spiritual load for us at that time, but fairly poorly. Meeting attendance. Anyway, I'm sitting in my office one day, and this guy comes into my office, and I'd represented him off and on for years, and he was a landscaper, or so I thought. And he comes in my office, and more to be revealed. And he tells me that he'd gotten in a little bar fight and needs me to represent him on this little, you know, misdemeanor assault charge. And I said, all right, you know, that's fine. It was February 2007. It's in Asheville, North Carolina. It's in the winter. It's cold. And so I said to him, you know, well, that'll be $500 for that. And he's like, well, you know, I don't have that much money right now. And he's a landscaper. It's the winter. It kind of made sense to me, right? And back in those days, we bartered a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd take, you know, one time we took a big load of firewood from this guy. One time we took the title to an old boat. And then when summer came around and the tourist season kind of started again, they'd come in and pay off their tab, and I'd give them back whatever. So he said, you know, can we barter a little bit? I was like, sure, what you got? And as God is my witness, he said, how about an eight ball? And looked me dead in the eye. And suddenly, that was the best idea I'd ever had. Suddenly, it in a nanosecond, like, why haven't I thought of this before? Oh, my God. Like, I'm so tired. Jonathan is such a butt. My kids are so ungrateful. My secretaries are lazy. All of a sudden, it all clicked, and it made the most sense in the whole wide world. And on top of that, my mind also said, which is where my alcoholism centers, the cocaine was never your problem, Marcia. It was the vodka that made you have the wreck that got you on the front page of the paper back in 2002, right? I mean, like, that quickly. So we did that deal, and you know, I went to the bathroom and did that big first line, and then, of course, my car was on autopilot to the liquor store, and then we're off to the races one more time. Mm-hmm. But I'd never had an experience where, without any thought or effort, no planning on my part, suddenly, the thought occurs to me. And that's what this is talking about here, right? So these observations would be academic and pointless about the fact that after that day, I didn't draw really a sober breath unless I was locked up until the day I got sober. That would be pointless and academic if I had never taken the first one. So the big question mark in the sky is, why do we take the first one when there's nothing in our body?
Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to answer that?
Yeah.
I remember that day vividly because I was born in 67. This was 2007, so I think I was 39, almost turning 40, and I was a cocaine virgin.
God bless him.
But I wasn't, by the time Marcia got home from work that day, you know, she introduced me to the whole powder cocaine thing, and that's what we were, you know, running and gunning with until we couldn't find any, and then it turned into crack, and, you know, I mean, like she said, we were off to the races. But, you know, one of my main mental obsession stories was, you know, in the fall of 2007, a short 6 months before I got sober, Marcia and I both needed separation, you know, and so we had decided to go to this place in the hill country or in the outside of Asheville, North Carolina. That was a 45-day treatment center, And for obvious reasons, they wouldn't take a husband and wife at the same time. So it's kind of a flip of the coin, you know, and Marcia went first. And so Marcia goes first, and, you know, when she goes, I say to myself, you know, what a prime opportunity for me to get sober at the same time, you know? She's going to be gone. My bad influence is missing. You know, I've got all this responsibility now. I got to take care of the five kids and you know, run everything while she's away, you know, getting treated for her addiction and alcoholism. And, you know, obviously that's not how it played out. I mean, I went harder than I ever had before when I was solo. And but what happened was, you guys that have been in treatment probably know, lots of places have like a family program. And so what I did is, this place was about 30 minutes away from our house. And I was doing, I was doing Percocet, and I was drinking whiskey, and I was doing powder. And I brought everything that I had to this hotel that was, you know, right around the corner from the treatment center. And this was Sunday night. Family week started Monday morning. And so I'm up until 4:30 or 5 in the morning. I finish all the cocaine. I finish all the whiskey. I do all the opiates that I had. And then I waltz into the family program, you know, Monday morning. And thinking to myself, you know, I've been in the treatment game. You know, I've been in so many treatments. I mean, this is lame. They can't teach me anything. But, you know, I managed to just muscle through hour by hour. I mean, kill me now. You know, I mean, I was sitting there, you know, with all the crying family members, and I'm just kind of detoxing. And Marcia's looking healthy, which pisses me off. And, you know, this was Thanksgiving week. And so what happened was, you know, Monday, I'm just able to, you know, white knuckle it. I purposefully designed this. You know, I'm far away from the dealer. I'm out in the middle of nowhere. I can't get anything. And so this is going to be my plans and designs on finally getting sober. And so by the time Thursday came, right, I have 3 or 4 days under my belt. There's no more cocaine in my system. There's no more whiskey in my system. There's no more opiates in my system. Stone cold sober. Nothing inside me demanding to be fed, right? There's no phenomenon of craving. There's no physical allergy. And, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, you know, comes at the rehab. And I leave the following day, Friday, with 5 days of sobriety under my belt. And a sincere desire to stay sober, right? I can't let Marcia punk me. She's already ahead of me, right? I need to stay sober. She's sober. We got kids. We got businesses and stuff like that. And our little 2-year-old son, Sheldon, was at the house or was being watched by a family friend. And so I leave the treatment center, you know, again, with a firm resolution and nothing in my body. And I go home and I pick up Sheldon. And I'm walking around this big vacant house with all of my unmanageability and all the guilt, shame, and remorse that I had accumulated, you know, over the previous 38 years, and my mental fortitude. And I walked around that house. I tried my best to read a book to Sheldon. You know, I played with him. I tried to keep ourselves busy. And you guys know what happened. I mean, as the seconds and the minutes tick by, I'm just like, I can't do this. I can't do this, you know? And again, tears running down my face. I load him up into the car, and I go to the dealer's house with 5 days sober, every reason to stay sober, but with no mental defense against that unprotected thought. And, you know, the paragraph that she read that says, you know, these observations would be academic and pointless. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. I don't want to rewrite the big book, but I really feel like the main problem of the alcoholic, instead of even centers in his mind, centers in his spirit. Mm-hmm. Because it's my spiritual status, it's my spiritual condition that, if fractured, will allow that unprotected thought to come in. And I'm telling you guys right now, at almost 10 years sober, I shared about my sponsee that relapsed, you know, last night, or a couple of nights ago, and is now in Williamson County Jail. They're doing for him what he couldn't do for himself. But I'm real clear that right now, at 10 years, if I receive an unprotected thought, I'm smoking crack. I mean, that's what this thing is. That's what we're up against. I mean, the order of defense is this, and we're about to get into it because we're about to get into unmanageability and step two and stuff like that. But, you know, what will prevent me from experiencing the phenomenon of craving? Well, not putting it in. But how can I not put it in based on my history of always putting it in? Especially toward the end, oftentimes against my own will. Never in the book does it teach me how to combat the mental obsession. Never in the book does it say, once you've put it in, this is a nifty way to get around the craving. Right? It doesn't address any of that stuff. The order of defense is this. I've got to stay spiritually fit. If I'm spiritually fit, it doesn't matter. If I have to file bankruptcy, it doesn't matter what circumstances come my way. I will be safe and protected from that unprotected thought that will lead me to make one of the most insane decisions I've ever made, which is to put alcohol and drugs back in my body after a period of abstinence. And so this whole kind of way of life, the 12-step process, the spiritual program of action, is all designed for one thing and one thing only, and that's to fine-tune my spiritual status. And if my spirit is in good condition, I don't have to worry about that mental obsessive thought ever coming back. But that spiritual condition is always going to be predicated on what my feet are doing. Always on action. That's why it's a spiritual program of action, not a spiritual program of thinking real hard. Yeah. Right? You know, and the and that final, you know, analogy, and I talked about it at Spearheads, but it just makes so much sense to me and is so applicable, is that whole drowning analogy. Mm. Where, you know, if you go and you hold my head underwater, I'm going to hold my breath because I'm not stupid and I know I need air. But as the seconds and minutes tick by while my head is held underwater, the carbon dioxide goes up in my bloodstream, the oxygen's starting to deplete, and I start getting very, very uncomfortable. Now, right before I drown, what I will do is I'll take a desperate gasp underneath the surface of the water. Now, that's not because all of a sudden I think breathing water is a good idea. I'm real clear that it's going to end badly. Right? But I'm unable to not take the gasp once I get uncomfortable enough. And if you can line your experience with using and drinking against your own will with kind of the force of desperation that would come if you were under the water for 2 or 3 minutes, I've got about as much of a chance of staying sober based on staying sober being a good idea as I do of continuing to hold my breath and not breathing underwater once the screws start getting tightened that much. And that was my history for those 13 years. Like I said, I mean, some of the misinformation that I had around step one from really, really well-intentioned people were things like, you know, like I was talking about, you can do anything for 24 hours, can't you? No, I can't, right? Based on my experience. You know, you've got a problem with drugs and alcohol. You know, if you just would quit doing drugs and alcohol, you know, your problems would be solved. Well, that's bullshit, right? I mean, that's a gross, that's a gross, gross understatement, right? I mean, if you're like me and you suffer from what I suffer from, and you suffer like Bill and some of the other people in the Big Book suffered, then if you take away my alcohol and drugs, no matter what damage they're causing to me, I get worse, not better. And so I've got to find a sufficient substitute for what alcohol and drugs were doing for me. And guys, I'm telling you, I found that. If any of you out there, especially in your first 30 days, are under the impression that I'm almost 10 years sober, because for on a 24-hour basis now for almost 10 years, I've just been fighting the temptation to smoke crack. I mean, shoot me now. If that was what the program promised, if the program promised that I'd have the ability to wake up on a 24-hour basis, combat the obsession to smoke crack for 10 years in a row, I'd rather load us all up and go smoke crack right now. That holds no appeal to me. I mean, who the hell wants to live to be 80? And what, I got another 30 years of doing this, you know, daily battle? It's always funny to talk to people that don't understand alcoholism and addiction because, you know, me and Marcia have kids that are sober now and, you know, they'd get a DUI or get thrown in jail. And me and Marcia would, like, high-five each other, right? You know? I mean, like, yes, yes, you know? And I train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and so I tell some of the people in the gym what happened, and they're always like, oh, my God, I hate hearing that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the appropriate response.
Right.
That's the appropriate response to something like that. But, I mean, DUIs, treatment, you know, hitting bottom, I mean, that's a cause for us to celebrate. You know, that's a cause for us to celebrate. So, anyway.
All right, so if we go back to page 23 with what we were just talking about with mental obsession, the paragraph underneath the paragraph about the observations being academic and pointless really starts to get into, you know, the baffling nature of what we're talking about. Because, you know, my experience, and I'm sure that most of your all experiences, you know, when we were continuing to put it back in our body after some period of abstinence, people would ask us questions like, why are you doing that? Mm. Why are you ruining your life?
Yeah.
And we're saying stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But we don't even believe it, you know? Right. Like, it doesn't even make any sense. Like, well, you know, you didn't, you know, get me the baby alive that I wanted when I was 10. Mm. Or, you know, like, it doesn't even make sense, you know? Or, like, I wanted a red Corolla. I didn't want a black, you know, just whatever, like, whatever our mind tells us was our issue tends to come up when people are asking us those troubling questions like, why are you ruining your life? You know, mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? But the big book addresses it beautifully, and it says, once in a while, Marcia may tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And the truth, strange to say, is usually that she has no more idea why she took that first drink than you have. You know, I don't know if you guys have ever had that experience, especially for the moms or the dads in the room, of drinking or using after some time in recovery. Mm. So your kids and your spouse have, like, gotten this idea that things might just possibly be okay. Mm. And then you find yourself overserved, you know, and I don't know. I just always had this idea when I was drinking and using, like, I couldn't let my, quote, kids see me like this. Like, it was somehow better to disappear for days on end than it was to, you know, like, let them see me impaired. But, you know, that fatal hour comes where you're like, you know, you got to go home. And there's, like, no worse feeling in the world than driving home, or even worse for me, they didn't have Uber when I was really running and gunning, so you always had to, like, take a nasty cab home, and you're sitting back there, and it's just, like, nothing but shame and guilt, just like a cloak of dark fog around you. Mm. And your hand touches that front door, and you start walking in, and kids are, you know, eating their cereal or whatever, and your spouse is staring at you like you're such a piece of crap, and all those feelings. And then after that passes, then you start getting the questions. And the questions are things like, don't you know you're going to lose your job? Mm. Don't you know that I'm going to leave you if you keep doing this? Or your mom saying, don't you know that I'm going to take your kids, or Child Protective Services is going to take your kids? And of course, y'all, it's like we were talking about earlier, we're not stupid. We're not stupid. We know what's coming down the pipe. And so the answer to that question is right here. The truth, strange to say, is that she has no more idea why she took that first drink than you have. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the truth. I had no idea why I was behaving like this. I had no idea why I could not stop once I started. And I had no idea why I kept starting, knowing for sure what was coming at me. Mm-hmm. So when I really started to learn about, you know, this first step and really started to have it explained to me for the very first time, and I just have to say out loud, like, I'm so grateful for that. Mm-hmm. Because I walked around for, you know, for 6 years, really even longer than that. But for 6 years after the first time I went to treatment and I was supposed to stop drinking, I walked around for 6 years thinking that I was going to die drunk and high. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like that was my destiny.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been to enough meetings that I had heard this phrase, constitutionally incapable.
Mm-hmm.
And I believed that that applied to me. I left out the last part of that about being honest with myself, right? I just hung on to that constitutionally incapable because I saw people like coming in after I came in, sitting down in the chairs in the meeting and like staying sober and getting sober, and their life was good, and you know, they're getting raises and they're getting promotions and they're getting new cars, and they're not continuing to pick up white chips. And I saw people that I had gone to treatment with that stayed sober after the first time. And so I was looking at that evidence, what I called evidence, of what their experience was versus what my experience was, and I could not make sense of that. So the only conclusion that I could come to was that I was constitutionally incapable. And I knew that there was alcoholism in my family. Like, I knew that I had a couple of uncles that died of alcoholism. And I remembered the messaging that I had heard about that as a kid. And the messaging from well-meaning family members was, those uncle, you know, Uncle so-and-so, he didn't care about his family.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care about his kids. All he cared about was drinking. Mm-hmm. And if he'd wanted to stop drinking, he could have. Mm-hmm. And that was the messaging that I heard, y'all. And not only that, not only did I hear it as a kid, that was the messaging that I was hearing from my family members and even, quite frankly, from some well-meaning therapist,
mm-hmm.
even after I started trying to stop. Mm-hmm. So I did not have the information that I needed to put that puzzle piece together of why did I keep starting again? Why did I have no defense against that unprotected thought? And Jonathan started talking about it a little bit, but, you know, the missing piece for me all that time was I knew the solution, right, was this, you know, going to the 12-step meetings. I'd heard that was the solution, but I did not have a full understanding of the problem. And, you know, when we think about the magical coincidences that happened in order for us to be even having the 12 steps today, is that we had Bill Wilson, who knew the problem, and we had Dr. Bob, who knew the solution. And when you only have the solution, but you don't have a clear understanding of the problem, you've got a world of frustration. And you got 6 years trying to sit down in the solution and not really having an understanding of what is wrong with me. And that was my experience. You know, I knew I was supposed to go to detox. I knew I was supposed to go to treatment. I knew I was supposed to have a sponsor. I knew I was supposed to be in the 12-step meetings. But I had no clear understanding of the gravity of the problem that led me to the only solution being an experience with power. See, I grew up in South Georgia, y'all, and I always say it was Jesus and sweet tea, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I had no problem with Jesus. I had no problem with sweet tea.
That's right.
It was all good. We went to church. We ate chicken. We drank tea. We took a nap. We went back to church. Like, rinse and repeat, you know? So I had all this knowledge about God, and I had no qualms with God. But I had no idea that there was a living God that was personal to me, that cared about whether I put alcohol or drugs back into my body. You know, I just had this idea that God was kind of this big thing who had big problems, right? Mm-hmm. I felt like God was interested in famines and possibly global warming, earthquakes, you know, wars. Those were the big issues. But I had no idea that there was this ability, this possibility to have an experience with God, which is much different than just having a belief. I didn't even know that that was the problem. But when we finally start talking about the second half of the first step, about this unmanageability piece, when people started posing questions to me and asking me to reflect on even my earliest experiences and really explain to me what unmanageability meant, then all of a sudden, I was able to start lining up what the actual problem was. You know, we talk about it a lot, you know. Alcohol was not my problem. And drugs were not my problem. they were really, in fact, the only thing that enabled me to make it through life until recovery without committing suicide or you know, doing something even more hurtful to other people than that. Because when you're burdened with this unmanageability, with this spiritual disconnectedness, when you're observing and comparing everyone else's outsides with the way you feel inside, that's a very, very lonely place to be. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very disconnected place to be. I had no idea why, like, I would go to these church youth groups. I went my whole growing up years, and I saw people all around me having a real experience with those services, having a real experience and turning their life over to God and being changed from the inside out. I was observing all that happening, and even though I was sitting in the same room and in those same chairs, I was not having that same experience. Mm-hmm. And the only way that someone that's as disconnected, as broken, as internally unmanageable as someone like I am is going to be led and pushed into an experience like that is through this desperate need, through an experience with powerlessness through alcohol and drugs. That's my experience. I am so, you know, later on we're going to talk about step three, and one of my favorite lines in the book is it talks about the root of my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness, which is true. But after that it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and self-seeking. And before I really even experienced selfishness and self-centeredness that really started in, like, you know, late childhood, adolescence, early adulthood, before I even experienced that, I experienced this drivenness by fear well before that. Mm-hmm. So when we start talking about this unmanageability, and I'll let Jonathan talk about the bedevilments and all that kind of stuff that lead us into the questions of what is our current unmanageability, which is what we're talking about today. It helped me a lot when I was first considering the first step to bring those questions back to even before drugs and alcohol became my solution. Mm. So I'll let Jonathan start talking about the unmanageability.
So yeah, before I get into unmanageability, I just wanted to address the potential people in the room that are like, oh God, why are we still talking about the first step? Can we move on? And, you know, first of all, no, we can't. And you know, I think it's very important for people that are kind of confused or maybe people that, you know, have still maybe not connected the dots. Why the hell do we have to understand step one so well? I mean, what's the point? Yeah, I'm alcoholic. I drank too much. Let's move on. And the reason that I don't think step one can be talked about too much is that my clarity around my first step is what must dictate the level of participation I put into the program. Mm-hmm. I'll say that again. My clarity around my first step is what dictates my participation level. Right? So I've got to get a good, clear understanding of where I fall on that scale of alcoholism. And the scale, in my experience, doesn't refer to whether I'm living under a bridge or not. The scale that the Big Book talks about, I believe, refers to how badly have I lost the power to choose whether I will drink or whether I won't drink. And the paragraph that I like to focus on is that paragraph on page 34 that says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, hopefully by this time you'll figure out whether that's you or not. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. Does anyone want to define altogether for me? Altogether, right? How do I stop altogether? We are assuming, of course, that I want to stop. Whether such a person, that would be you, right? Whether I can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which I've already lost the power to choose whether I will drink or won't drink. And that's a very baffling sentence if you rely on your logic and your reasoning. That's one that demands experiential connection, right? So let's talk a minute about a non-spiritual basis. In other words, what this paragraph is saying is if you have not lost the power to choose, and again, I don't come to that conclusion based on what I wanted to have happened or whether I wished would have happened or the way that I saw it.
Right.
It's drawn just from the facts of my life, of my drinking and drugging resume. That's where I find out how badly I've lost the power to choose. And if I've lost the power to choose very badly, then my participation level must be higher. If I haven't lost the power to choose, and I'm still occupying the zip code where I can choose to drink or choose to get 2 months or choose to get 3 months this time, I don't have lots of experience with drinking against my own willpower, then I can probably be one of the guys that has a kick-ass life with going to a meeting once a year and picking up my chip.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The problem is most of us have fallen further down the scale than we realize or that we're willing to admit, and so our participation level is incongruent with the level of participation in our addiction and our alcoholism. That's the problem. Some different non-spiritual bases of recovery would be abstinence. Right? That's pretty non-spiritual. Anyone ever just participated in abstinence and you're a real alcoholic? I mean, that's brutal, right? But abstinence is a non-spiritual basis of recovery. Meeting attendance is a non-spiritual basis of recovery. Hanging out and fellowshipping is a non-spiritual basis of recovery, right? If that works for you, then fine. But I'm talking to the people that have tried that and are miserable, or that have tried that and continue to smoke crack against their own will. That's because you're combating you're bringing a knife to a gunfight, right? It's insufficient. Therapy, exercise, travel, religion, the right girl, the right amount of money in the bank, all those things are non-spiritual bases of combating what's wrong with me. It's very, very important, and this is why we hammer step one. I've got to see my truth, like what she was talking about, constitutionally incapable. What the sentence says is there's some people that are constitutionally incapable of of being honest with themselves. And it's not about telling myself the truth in general. It's not about giving the right change back at the 7-Eleven. Constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself regarding my relationship with my drug of no choice. That's what it's talking about. And if I am constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself about my relationship to my drug of no choice, then I've got no shot. I've got to get a clear understanding of what I suffer from and how much trouble I'm in. Like I said in the thing, I mean, this is a disease of minimization, and I'm always in more trouble than I think I am. I'm always in more trouble than I think I am. And again, the more trouble you're in, the higher your level of participation. And we'll hopefully, get into that some this afternoon. But I wanted to talk a little about unmanageability now. And I told my story the last two nights, and lots of times you get up from the podium, or you share in a meeting, and, you try to get some laughs, you try to connect with people, and what you're essentially sharing is external unmanageability, right? Getting kicked out of vet school 6 months short of graduation, losing custody of my children, right? Getting divorced, picking up felonies, having my cars repossessed, having my house foreclosed on. I mean, all those are crappy things to happen. I'm not trying to sell you on those, but I am telling you that that's not what the book's referring to when it refers to unmanageability. The problem with the external unmanageability and the confusion is that it tends to divide us rather than unite us. If you've never been in vet school and gotten kicked out 6 months short of graduation, I guess you're not an alcoholic like I am, right? If you have kids but they haven't been taken by Child Protective Services, maybe you've got a few good years left of smoking crack. Right? External unmanageability is just what happens when I drink or drug too much. It's just the consequences and the circumstances of my drinking and drugging. It has nothing to do with what the big book talks about, in my opinion. based on experience. What the Big Book refers to is this internal unmanageability. If there's 50 people in the room and we went around, I mean, first of all, we'd probably be here for 6 months. But if there's 50 people in the room and we went around and everyone explained the circumstances of their life, their external unmanageability, they would all be different. But the one uniting thing, regardless of what your story is the internal description of how you felt the last time you put drugs and alcohol in your body. And the book uses words like terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, loneliness, fear, uselessness, right? All of those things are the internal unmanageability, and the internal is what unites us. The internal is what that we can all, you know, wrap our brains and our experience around, whether it was crack or heroin or meth or weed or alcohol, right? It's the internal feeling that, left unattended, will get treated one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I'll either treat it with a high level of participation, or I'll treat it with a hell of a lot of crack cocaine. That's my experience. And, you know, I think that with unmanageability, I know there's people that have been in the room for a while, I mean, been, you know, sober and probably participating at a high level for a while. But I think one of the tricky things, the longer you stay sober, is trying to pinpoint current manifestations of unmanageability, right? Because, I mean, if I'm 10 years sober, I'm not getting kicked out of vet school. My kids aren't being taken by Child Protective Services and all that other BS that comes along with active addiction. But I need to be clear, the longer that I'm sober, that unmanageability can still be a current part of my life, right? Mm. And it's very, very tricky. And lots of times it, you know, camouflages itself. And I wanted to share a brief experience I had a couple of years ago. And I couldn't see it at the time, but in hindsight, this is a current manifestation of unmanageability, right? I had a Jeep Wrangler. I had a Range Rover before that. But I sold the Range Rover and got a Jeep Wrangler because I was trying to downsize. You know, we're trying to save some money. If you guys heard my story, that's when I stopped working full time and went to just like, you know, real, real part time, like semi-retired, you know, level of work. And so I was driving this Jeep and I loved the Jeep. It was great. You know, I could take the top off and in the sun in Texas, you know, it was fun. The boys loved it. But after I'd had the Jeep for about a year or 18 months, Marcia pulls back up into the driveway with the Mercedes GL 450.
And that was a gift.
Yeah, it was a gift, but that's immaterial. And I parked my Jeep next to that Mercedes. I started thinking to myself, something's wrong with this picture. You know? And I mean, I sat with it just internally for about a week, but every time I pulled up, I'm like, this Jeep's a piece of shit. I've never liked this Jeep. You know what I mean? It's bumpy. It hurts my back. It's not that comfortable. You know, and so eventually, what did I do? Call my sponsor? No. What I did is I went down to the Range Rover dealership, and I traded in that Jeep and drove home with a brand new Range Rover. Now all is right with my world, right? Now we're even. Now we're even. Now all of a sudden I don't feel less than. And let me ask you this. How long do you think that effect produced from buying that Range Rover lasted? 5 days maybe. 5 days max, right? 5 days max. Again, the delusion is the Jeep versus the Mercedes isn't a problem, right? Mm. And if things were just... But that's the way that unmanageability presents itself. Lots of times it's jealousy. Lots of times it's comparisons, right? Lots of times it's overly inwardly focused, right? Just too much focus, like I was talking about, on how I feel, right? Unmanageability, guys, for me at least, has always been there. But this is the way it started out with me. When I was in high school, I couldn't wait to get to college. Then I got to college and I'm like, shit, that's not it. I guess I need to get married. Then I got married and I'm like, well, that really wasn't it. You know what I mean? Not to her. That's my ex. And then I thought, I think I need to have a kid. Then I had a kid. And then I thought, no, I need to go to graduate school. Nope, I got a doctorate, became a veterinarian, got my own animal hospital. Nope, that wasn't it. And unmanageability presents like a mirage in the desert. I get to where I thought that it was, and then I'm sorely disappointed.
Yeah.
It wasn't there. And the whole kind of mindset in my mind behind unmanageability is that, God forbid I ever look inward. God forbid I ever look inward and work on my relationship with power. It's always got to be outside. And that's the stuff that creates the words in the book like full of fear, can't make a living, I feel useless, I have no sense of direction, I don't feel any kind of peace of mind. And that's what happens when I get too caught up in the trappings of the external world. And that's how unmanageability has always presented in my life. It's always a mirage, and it's always BS. It's never the good dope. It's always just, you know, the stopgap measures that allow me to focus my mindset on the next new thing. So,
good. We suffer from the delusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
If we only manage well.
Correct.
If we only get the new car.
Right.
And I would like to add a little something to that story. Because when we're in it, we can't see it.
Yeah.
We are absolutely unable to see it.
Mm-mm.
Because while all that was going down, Jonathan, who, you know, quite frankly, is one of the most consistent and one of the most spiritually driven guys I've ever known, and is on guard against current unmanageability. While that was happening, he was saying things to me like, I know this looks like self-will, but...
No.
I don't want you to think that I'm trying to treat my internal condition with...
It's just time for a new car.
Right.
Yeah.
You might not be aware of this, but I've been looking at these cars,
yes,
and this is the exact two-tone interior that they never make.
Prayerful consideration.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because I think one of our obligations in recovery is to have spiritual consent with one another,
mm-hmm,
so that we can hold the mirror up to the disease of addiction that is alive in every one of us. You know, one of the things that I'm very clear about, the big book talks about, we straighten out spiritually and then we straighten out mentally and physically.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The spiritual malady is eventually suppressed by treating our alcoholism or our addiction with the 12-step process, but it's never gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mental obsession can be combated with spiritual fitness. Physical allergy can be combated with spiritual fitness,
mm-hmm,
and by not falling prey to the mental obsession because of spiritual fitness. But spiritual fitness is a daily reprieve,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
We have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. But our spiritual condition is never, ever cured.
Mm-hmm.
So... when we go to page 44 and 45, we're going to start, you know, creeping into why we need this power. And I think that we've talked a lot right now about unmanageability, you know, whether it's something that we're looking back that was present in our life before we ever drank or used, or whether we're looking at something that's present in our life even after recovery. But on the bottom of page 44... in the chapter to the agnostics, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? So, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, back on page 23 when we were starting to talk about this mental obsession piece. And you remember we talked some about when we stay away from drink for months or years, we start to look much like other people. Well, this is another sort of nod to that. Because when we're staying away from drink, when we're practicing abstinence as our spiritual treatment, quote unquote, we start to look much like our neighbors. We even start to feel much like our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're using these codes of morals and philosophies of life as an attempt to combat a spiritual problem, we're going to fail utterly. So this is what we're kind of walking into right now. We're walking into the possibility. Is it possible that I'm going to need spiritual help to overcome this alcoholism and this addiction? And, you know, I was talking a little bit about having some knowledge about the solution, but not really understanding the problem when it was coming to really conceding to my first step. And I remember when I finally was introduced into the big book, Coming Alive, I was so angry because I was saying things to my sponsor like, what the F? I've been going to these meetings for all these years and I have never heard that God, a relationship with God, was the solution to my alcoholism. And then about 5 years later, Jonathan and I were packing up our stuff to move. And I unpacked one of my big books from way back when. It was so crazy. Because in this very first title page, where it says, how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism? I had circled the word recovered, and I'd drawn an arrow, and I had written, I need a relationship with God. And it was so baffling to me. Like, how did that happen? And I didn't even know that that happened, and I was arguing about how the hell could that not have happened, you know? Yeah. But like Jonathan was saying last night, you know, the receiver was broken. Mm-hmm. I was broken, not the transmitter. You know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And all of those sort of adages like that. But when I finally got convinced that if I did not have a relationship with power, that this unmanageability that I feel with every breath I take, this crippling selfishness, this crippling focus on self and fear and loneliness and all of these things that people like me and you just walk around with, and we stand it till we can't stand it anymore, and then we take that drink or we take that hit or we take that pill, and we can breathe again. When you really understand that the only solution to that is a spiritual solution, then you're driven into the steps. But, you know, there's a part of the book that says, in the last analysis that can be found. And I swear, you know, I was so headstrong and so, you know, self-will run riot. I was going to check every box of that analysis before I was willing to concede that I had to humble myself before a power greater than myself. And that sounds like a really, like a big ego thing to say, and it is. But I don't care if your ego shows up like martyrdom or self-will or ambition or workaholism or disordered eating or, you know, I don't care how your ego shows up. If your ego is continuing to show up, then that's your problem too. Stone cold sober. So it says, obviously, but where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So what's my problem? What is my problem? Lack of power? Sure. But why do I need power? Because of these things that are on page 52. We ask ourselves... We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our problem the same readiness to change our point of view. And then it starts to ask those questions that really define our untreated alcoholism. Whether you've never been sober or whether you've been sober for 10 years, are you having trouble with personal relationships? Is your partner pissing you off? Is your boss an idiot? I sponsor so many people right now that have the dumbest bosses on the planet. You know? It's like they just flock to me. Is it possible that your judgment of your partner or your boss or your roommate or the people in your home group are connected to your current unmanageability? Is it possible? Can you control your emotional nature? Is it possible that your current depression or your current anxiety are connected to your current unmanageability? Is it possible? Are you a prey to misery and depression? Is it possible that this stale feeling that you have about your recovery or about your home group or about, you know, AA in Atlanta or whatever, is it possible that that's connected to your current unmanageability? Because if I can get dissatisfied with my home group, alcoholism and addiction can attack me on the flank, you know? Are you able to make a living? Are you constantly miserable with whatever it is that you're doing? Is that connected to your unmanageability, your untreated alcoholism or addiction? Are you full of fear? Are you sure that the shoe's going to drop? Is your glass always half empty? Those are ways of saying that. Is something bad around the corner? Are you looking at life from a standpoint of scarcity versus abundance? Is that your current unmanageability? Are you unhappy? Are you constantly waiting for people to cheer you up? You know? Are you constantly waiting for the guy that's in the home group with you to catch your eye so you can feel that butterfly in your stomach? Welcome. Welcome. Are you helpful to other people? Do you decline calls from people that need help? Are you too busy for an H&I? Are you too busy to take a service commitment at your home group? Are you too sober to do those things? I had someone of 25 years tell me, "Oh, I'm too sober to sponsor the newcomers." Really? Really? I work better with people with untreated alcoholism. Really? I guess I missed that in the appendix. So what is the basic solution to these bedevilments? What does bedevilments mean? It's such a weird word, right? All right, but when we're talking about this unmanageability, like Jonathan was saying, like, we all have colorful consequences when we put alcohol and drugs into our bodies. You know, I never had the good grace to stay home. I was always out with my guns drawn, you know, like making a scene and getting arrested and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I have lots of colorful consequences, right? But that's not what made my life unmanageable. It's not what makes my life unmanageable today. What makes me unmanageable is that I'm disconnected from power. The God in me can't connect with the God in you if I'm not in fit spiritual condition. I'm not going to be willing to be helpful. I'm not going to be willing to look at my own relationship with alcohol and drugs, with my own relationship with powerlessness, bodily and mentally, if I'm disconnected. If I'm treating my alcoholism with something other than a spiritual context, I'm unmanageable. And this happens 100% of the time in recovery. The big book even talks about we're not washed white as snow. We couldn't be helpful if we were. So if I'm unwilling to talk about, like Jonathan was doing, how my unmanageability shows up and I treat it with a new car or a new purse, I mean, I'll just do mascara. Like, I'll do whatever, you know. But if I'm not willing to be honest about that and look at that, then there's no way I'm going to be able to stay connected to my powerlessness. And if I'm not connected to my powerlessness, alcohol and drugs will show up. I have experience with that. Jim has experience with that. Fred has experience with that. Every single person in this room has your own experience with that. And if you're a real alcoholic, as Mike Dolphin says, if you be the real man, it's not a matter of if you're drinking again, my friends. It's when. Mm-hmm. It's when. And that's why we stay active in this work. That's why we stay connected to our first step and talk about it out loud and share it with other people. And come to places like this and have little funny anecdotes that we can all relate to mm-hmm. about what alcoholism looks like now, what addiction looks like now.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, too, you know, that sentence that Marshall talked about, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. I used to just skip over that sentence until it was brought to my awareness. You know, someone asked me, you know, Jonathan, did your parents sit you down when you were little and say, Jonathan, let me tell you about some hopes and dreams I have for you. One of the things I really hope is that you steal morphine from the vet school 6 months short of graduation.
Yeah, that's right.
I really hope my desire for you, and it always has been, that you smoke crack cocaine with hookers, you know, in your 30s and 40s. That's really what I have in my sights set out for you, you know. And you know, the truth is, there's very few people that were raised with the message from their parents, please, please become an addict or an alcoholic. You know what I mean? We all have some type of moral compass, some type of internal barometer that I think what happens if you go at the game long enough is you start trampling on your values and on your ethics and on your code of morals so much that towards the end, you can't get high enough mm-hmm. to dull the sense of shame and remorse and guilt that you experience. So if I was able to just, you know, apply what I learned in Sunday school, then I probably wouldn't have been smoking crack. You know, I was raised with certain sense of what's right and what's wrong. But what happens is, you know, and it doesn't happen usually in a major seismic shift. But what happens is that incrementally I allow more dishonesty into my life to where all of a sudden I was heading north. And now I'm heading south, you know? And it wasn't a 180, it was just very, very gradual. And the same thing can happen, you know, when you're sober. Well, that's not really dishonest, right? My motives were good. It's really dangerous to hide behind good motives, right? It's really dangerous to hide behind good motives. And I was going to say, too, you know, as much as I think that there's a big, the importance of unmanageability is there. Notice the workshop was not entitled Staying Connected to Your Unmanageability. It's called Staying Connected to Your Powerlessness. And the reason for that is that my own personal experience is that it's very difficult. While I need to concede my unmanageability and what it looks like currently, it's very difficult to muster up enough fuel to go through the pesky 12 steps based solely on unmanageability. What differentiates me, I'm a big believer that the human race suffers from unmanageability, right? The difference between me and my mom's unmanageability is that I've got the threat of smoking crack cocaine behind not addressing it. My mom may, you know, drink a glass of wine or, you know, yell at her husband. You know, I've got to keep the real piece of business buoyed above the horizon. At the end of the day, if I ignore my unmanageability, if I ignore my spiritual malady, if I ignore the sense of disconnectedness, if I ignore these bedevilments in my life, then at the end of the day, I am smoking crack cocaine. And it doesn't matter whether I have 10 years, and it sure as hell doesn't matter that I don't feel like smoking crack cocaine. Again, what I said in the meeting the other night is so true. The people are at real risk if they are under the impression that not feeling like drinking is somehow a defense against not drinking. If you've got any experience at all with drinking or drugging against your own will, then you'll understand that statement and realize that just because I don't feel like it doesn't mean that it's not coming down the corner, coming around the corner. So, you want to do any questions?
Or I'll just take a break.
Okay. I think we're going to take a break, guys. And when we get back, Lindsay, do you need to talk to everyone?
No.
Okay. So we'll get back. Come back at 1? Come back at 1?
1.
All right. 1 o'clock, guys.
Oh, yeah. If you want to stay, pizza's going to be here in like, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes.
Do we need to pause?
I don't know.